As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, this is Pod on the Tyne, the Athletic's Newcastle United podcast. I'm Taylor Payne. I'm with George Colgan, currently undergoing an intensive decompression process. I'm joined by the boy wonder, Jacob Whitehead, and boy-sized thunderer, Chris Woff. How the devil are you, Jacob? Nice to have you back.
I'm good. Boy wonder. What a compliment. Thank you very much, Taylor. I don't usually get that.
Don't thank me, mate. I didn't write it.
Well, I'd say that George, usually in quite a sort of Dorian Gray manner, sort of sustains his own youth and happiness by taking the piss out of mine and Chris's any joy absolutely. And happiness and using that as a sort of injection to sustain him. So you can really tell he's not about today.
It's not working either, is it? Let's be honest. Judging by the last couple of weeks, it certainly hasn't worked. Chris Woff's here as well. Chris, you all right?
Yeah, I've got my phone ready here just in case George does need rescuing. So I may have to leave the podcast at any moment if George breaks down anywhere. So, but no, I'm all right, thank you. Yeah, I'm all right. It's been a weird week in terms of in the world of Newcastle United, but we'll come on to that. So yeah, it's been a bit hard to cover, but yeah.
Well, yeah, we will.
How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm not too bad. I've still got this horrific chest cough thing, which seems to have been lurking around for a while. I think I might just have to live with it now. I think that's it. I think it's become part of me. I might give it a name, maybe Kevin.
Named after the manager? Someone who always stays with you inside?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's it, Keegan. Right, let's crack on then. There's plenty to talk about. Let's have a listen to David Ornstein talking about Dan Ashworth.
It's my understanding that Ashworth has informed Newcastle United, his current employers, that he has been approached by Manchester United regarding the role of sporting director. Now, to our knowledge, there is still no formal contact between the two clubs on the subject, but that is expected to follow soon with Newcastle United in a strong position given that they hold Ashworth's contract and therefore they can demand significant compensation from Manchester United if indeed he is to leave St James's Park for Old Trafford. Now, this is a move that seems to be gathering pace and we do expect developments to occur pretty rapidly. I don't think Newcastle will just roll over and let it happen. They will only do this on their terms. But I don't sense a massive desire to send him out on gardening leave for as long as possible and deny Manchester United access to him simply out of spite. That may happen, that he goes on gardening leave for a period of time. But I think the priority for them will be to strike a deal that is right for them monetarily.
Right then, wow, this has escalated quickly, Chris, hasn't it? The right deal monetarily, David said there. It makes it sound like the club are planning for his departure. Yeah, there's been no official approach by Manchester United as of yet, has there?
Well, so you said it's escalated quickly, and it has, and it hasn't. And that's what's been the difficulty of covering the story. It's
escalated
been like
quickly over the last 6 or 7 months, Chris. I think that's what we're trying to do.
Well, exactly,
to get
but
at.
This is almost like it feels like an extension of the January window, and now this is going to be, this is a sort of woe is me, one of those, everyone's going to be sitting at home with the smallest violin in the world. But these sort of stories are awful for journalists to cover, and the reason for that is there's been a heck of a lot of noise from the Manchester United side this week, but as of yet, nothing has fundamentally changed. I mean, it has because of the situation that's out there and the fact that Dan Ashworth and Newcastle United as of yet haven't been able to clarify that. But there has been an approach by Manchester United to Dan Ashworth to say that they have an interest in him, but the official approach to Newcastle United has not come yet, as you mentioned. And so Dan Ashworth remains, as of it's 1:14 on Thursday afternoon. As of now, Dan Ashworth has been working today. He is expected to be at St James's Park on Saturday for Newcastle United against Bournemouth. He remains the sporting director of Newcastle United. And yet the noise which has been around, we had the situation in November when Newcastle won at Man United. Gary Neville tweeted his admiration for Dan Ashworth. Dan Ashworth had then asked about that and sort of just joked on and but said, look, very nice that Gary Neville said some nice things about me, but there's nothing there at this stage. And then you get into December, the rumours ramp up a heck of a lot, and there's people inside Newcastle who are fearful that Dan Ashworth is going at that stage. Nothing then comes of it. The situation sort of dilutes and quietens down over January. By the end of January, it almost feels like the situation may have gone away. And then over the course of the last sort of 3 days, suddenly it has really ramped up again, and it seems that Man United are readying themselves for this approach. A heck of a lot of information is coming out on that side, but really we're in this weird holding pen situation where the official approach hasn't come yet. Dan Ashworth remains in situ, and yet it feels like it's almost inevitable that he's going to go.
Yeah, I really hope the approach to Dan came in the form of a Valentine's card from Dave Brailsford. That would be fabulous, wouldn't it? If it's been the last couple of days, rose are red, violets are blue. How would you like to work for Man U? I hope that's what was written inside of it.
Have you just made that up now, or have you been practicing that?
I've literally just made that up now. No, I haven't practiced that. That came off the top of my head, Chris. How dare you? How dare you, Christopher Wolf?
We do get a window into what Taylor's Valentine's Day is like, though.
Absolutely. He is under contract, though, isn't he, Jacob? So we, as Brighton, are in a pretty strong position.
Yeah, in the sense that, like any club, Newcastle don't want to have people who don't want to be there, but they hold the cards when it comes to actually controlling the circumstances of any exit. So some of this is conjecture because of, as Chris said, the lack of information on the Newcastle end. But typically in these sorts of contracts, Ashworth could, for example, choose to resign, but then that means that a long gardening leave kicks in, which could be a year or so, which at a club like Man U, you don't really have the luxury of waiting 12 months for those sorts of things for that to come to an end. And so then Newcastle have a right to demand a large amount of compensation to allow Ashworth to start work quicker, which is exactly what Newcastle did with Brighton. So in that sense, they are able to, and you hope that they will, milk the most they can out of what still isn't an ideal situation, because Ashworth obviously was handpicked by the new ownership and seen as central spoke of the wheel when it comes to rebuilding Newcastle.
There's been a lot of talk about this compensation, Chris, hasn't there? And there's been some figures thrown around this week. Like, even for a very high-profile executive, could the compensation involved make much of a difference to Newcastle?
Well, it would from a profitability and sustainability FFP point of view, in the sense that any money Newcastle recoup, just as there's the money that they paid to Brighton for Dan Ashworth, which was it was multi-million pound. I never got fully confirmed how much it was, but it was multi-million pounds. That added into Newcastle's PSR calculations. So if Newcastle are able to extract a decent amount of compensation, now even if Manchester United extract Dan Ashworth from his contract and he does serve his gardening leave, there is already compensation due to Newcastle, but they could demand more to try and, if they want to get him earlier and cut short that gardening leave. So in theory, Newcastle could add quite a bit to the PSR calculation. Yes, it's not the same as selling a player for £50 million, but they could get quite a few million out of this. And in that sense, that is of a benefit. I mean, it is a very weird situation right now, and it does feel like there's been a frustration, I think, in Newcastle over the course of the last couple of months from at least some people that Dan Ashworth hasn't clarified whether he is going to stay. And I've mentioned this before on the podcast, that I think that Ashworth's argument would be, certainly until this week, there hadn't actually been an approach, and therefore how can he distance himself from something which he doesn't know what the offer would be. He doesn't know both in terms of monetarily, but also what that sort of scope of that role would be. But the fact that we've reached this stage and there's been all this noise over the course of the last 48 hours, it does feel almost, certainly even if Dan Ashworth end up staying, that in the short term there's going to be collateral damage because of the fact he hasn't committed, he hasn't come out and said, no, I want to stay at Newcastle United. There feels like there's going to be a fallout from that, which might be unfair to a certain degree because of what he may argue in return. But equally, that lack of seemingly public commitment is an issue and has created this instability around Newcastle this week, which is not ideal for anyone. So it is a very, very odd situation.
I quite like that the sort of compensation places him in a roughly similar ballpark to Javier Manquillo in terms of PSR. Just thinking them as a sort of combination, unlikely twosome. And it's kind of poetic for Ashworth's final action in a black and white executive suit could be selling him.
I think Ashworth was a fullback as well, wasn't he? In his playing days, have I got that wrong?
I think so. Yeah, I think he was. Yeah,
yeah, that rings a bell. It's about right then, isn't it? It seems like about the right sort of asking price for a fullback. It's not in that clip, Chris, but David Ornstein suggested we'd have no problem finding an adequate replacement. Can we reassure fans who might view this as being pushed around a bit by Man United?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in the extent that yes, Newcastle would undoubtedly believe that they can bring someone else in to replace Dan Ashworth. Now, what's interesting about that is, and I'm not going to speculate on names yet because Newcastle aren't in that position. A, Dan Ashworth's still in situ, and B, yeah, they haven't started looking. And I mean, some names are being thrown around already, some of which I've checked out and have sort of been suggested that maybe there isn't that much in them, but other ones, who knows what. But what I'm going to discuss is the profile of what Newcastle would necessarily look for on that stage. Dan Ashworth, as Jacob mentioned, was handpicked. They actually brought in a recruitment firm to conduct a full search, and Dan Ashworth came out on top. Then Newcastle were willing to wait and pay Brighton to get him. They thought, this is the man, we need to build the club. That's what they talked about, building the club from the bottom up. And structures have been put in place that weren't there previously. It was a skeleton staff under Mike Ashley. A lot of departments didn't even exist, which do exist now. We've had the head of psychology has arrived and people like that. The scouting department has been bolstered significantly, and Dan Ashworth has been at the very centre of that. He is focused on sorting all of that out. Now, that work is far from finished. He's only 20 months into the role, which really, he says, you usually need 5 or 6 years to sort of build up a club. But the foundations are in place. So do they actually need someone to come in who would sort all of those foundations, or do they want someone who's a little more specialist in one of the areas which a sporting director can be? You have so many different titles for these positions, and that'll be interesting to see when Newcastle decide they want to go from that, because Ashworth has done a heck of a lot of good work, but equally, I don't think it's so fundamental that Newcastle as a club cannot progress without him. He was seen as being the one to start that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Newcastle can't push on from this stage. So yes, there will be a heck of a lot of executives who'd be very interested in this role.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
I'd eat orchid.
You'd have to say though as well, Jacob, looking at his history, he's not exactly been in a job for a long, long time, has he? He kind of has a little bit of a pattern of building, starting to build clubs and then moving on.
Maybe if you look at his last couple, he was at VFA for a good long time before, and you can really see the benefits of that now. I know that kind of the Athletic have reported that kind of privately, he even feels like he left Brighton a little bit early, and Newcastle will be even shorter still.
Yeah.
I think context worth noting is that his family's still based in the West Midlands. Brighton and Newcastle are not near the West Midlands, as I'm sure George will have complained on multiple occasions.
Yeah.
And I think everyone will kind of know there's always circumstantial reasons why work might not quite be what you hoped it to be. So that really sounded like an indirect at The Athletic. I love it here.
You digging us out there with that. That's terrific. Thanks for that, Jacob.
No, Taylor, you're the filling in my sandwich, the light of my life.
Oh, my word.
Well, you call me the boy wonder already, so I just need to pay it back. It's Valentine's Day. Yeah. Anyway, Dan Ashworth. So I think it's possibly unfair to say that he is a flitter. I mean, I'd say his last two jobs, and there are circumstantial reasons behind, and he's not gone yet.
No, exactly. Well, that's it. He's not gone yet. There has been some fun and games, though, Chris, hasn't it, on the reporting of this story, which you've enjoyed immensely. The idea that he was singularly responsible for any of our major transfer business is slightly misleading, isn't it? And maybe misunderstanding of his role.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Dan Ashworth has been central to a lot of those transfer negotiations, and that is part of his role. He's at the top of that. But actually, if you look back, when Jacob mentions that maybe the role at Newcastle, maybe the job has come with slight tensions, as these things always do, is that to a certain degree, Newcastle built backwards. Yeah. What you would usually have, as Manchester United seem to be doing, is you build from the top down, and they've brought in their chief executive from Man City. They're then looking for their sporting director or whatever role he's going to be, and they want Dan Ashworth for it. He then appoints people below him. Newcastle, given the situation they were in, because they wanted to get the right person as sporting director, they actually appointed Eddie Howe first. They had the head coach in place 3 months in theory, and then took longer for Dan Ashworth to come in before they got Dan Ashworth. They were also, the ownership during that first window were heavily involved in the recruitment of players alongside Steve Nixon, the head of recruitment, and then Andy Howe, who had followed his uncle from Bournemouth, who is the head of first team technical scouting. So they were already in position before Dan Ashworth comes in. And so that first window, if you go back to that, there was that transfer committee in place, and they had to do a lot of that sort of groundwork. And part of that then continued. They still were involved in some of it. So Dan Ashworth came in, but part of those structures were already in place. For example, the Anthony Gordon deal, Everton wanted it to be done on a sort of principal-to-principal level, is the way that they explained it. So Amanda Staveley led part of that as well. It wasn't always sort of Dan Ashworth. The same with Bruno Guimaraes' contract negotiations. In the end, the ownership got involved to sort of get that over the line. So Ashworth has been fundamental to a lot of what happens at Newcastle, but he isn't the only person in those situations. And he isn't this sort...
Yeah.
He isn't the same as Monchi, for example, at Aston Villa, who's seen as that sort of person who sort of handpicks these players. That's not what Dan Ashworth is. He's sort of... When he describes himself, and it's become a cliche now because he talks about it so much, he talks about being the centre of the wheel and having all the spokes coming off him. He has a head of recruitment in place, Steve Nixon, who was already there, who is the focus to bring in the players is there. He then goes and conducts the sort of negotiations and finalises a lot of those, but he isn't the person who goes and handpicks that. He sees himself far more as he promotes youth, and he's been heavily involved in sorting out the academy. Steve Harp, obviously, is the head of the academy, put a lot of trust and faith in him, but he's also bolstered it, Ashworth, by bringing in a lot of staff, bringing a lot more recruitment staff specialists there. And so that's sort of what he does. He basically enables other people to do their roles rather than being a recruitment specialist in his own right.
There has been a few bits and pieces on various media over the last few days talking about his wonderful record and bringing in Sven Botman and bringing in Bruno Guimaraes, Jacob, and stuff like that. But, you know, that Sven Botman deal was rumbling on 6 months before Ashworth was in position. Bruno Guimaraes joined the club before he was even there. So some of the noise is a little bit incorrect, isn't it?
Basically just a bit of failed due diligence for Sandro Tonali, right?
Maybe that's the only one, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, there has been a lot of this. Oh, he's done this, he's done that. He's, you know, he's responsible for this, he's responsible for that. But he's not as pivotal in some of those deals as what people have made him out to be.
You're right. And it's something which is, as Chris said, done as a club-wide effort. I suppose the thing is with Ashworth's role, and you can see the FA as an example, is that the proof of the good work that he does at a place isn't seen until a few years down the line. At the FA, it was remaking those structures so that you have the youth production, you have kind of Southgate's current setup, which has kind of springboard England towards their current major tournament success. In Newcastle, as Chris did say earlier, I mean, it was a skeleton staff. By doing that restructuring, that rebranding, in a few years' time, you may well see even more cogency. Newcastle is still lagging behind in a lot of areas. In a couple of years, that could well change, and lots of that will be down to Ashworth's interventions over the last 18 months, because that is his specialism, getting that in place.
I think as well, Chris, we actually had a tweet from Kay on Twitter as well, who said, it still feels like we're not allowed to have any nice things, which is, you know, it's fair enough. Like, there is a little bit of a perception among some fans that maybe we are being pushed around a little bit by Man United. But, you know, this is what happens in football, isn't it? There's always churn with some of these high-level executives. It can be the case that somebody comes in and they leave within a couple of years.
Is it coincidental you've come to me on this negative point, or...?
No, that's entirely meant. Yeah,
that's planned. I thought that might be the case.
As a man who's pushed around on this podcast.
Fair point, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I understand that sort of perception. I've seen a few people talking about I've even had people message me about the Andy Cole Manchester United deal in the 90s and how it feels like a sort of that's rekindling itself and that Newcastle again. But I mean, as ambitious as Newcastle's owners are and as ambitious as this project is, they're not that far along yet, and it's still that there is still the lure of Manchester United and what they are and what they've been historically. And I'm sure that part of Dan Ashworth's ego or other part of him would see it as to be the person who could potentially lead Manchester United to former glories is something he'd be very, very interested in. And Newcastle aren't being pushed around to the extent that, as things start, as I've said, there's been no official approach to Newcastle United yet.
Yeah.
And Newcastle don't want to say anything on the matter, but people in and around the club are adamant that they're not going to be pushed around. Look, if Man United want Dan Ashworth, for a start, why they're playing out in public like this, but if they do want him, they're going to have to come and they're going to have to pay what Newcastle want them to pay if they want to extract him early. And if they don't want to extract him early, then they have to pay the money anyway that they need to get him out of his contract, but then he's still going to have his period of gardening leave, and Newcastle will hold him to that. They're not being pushed around in that sense, but there is also an acceptance that if you keep Dan Ashworth and he has decided that he wants to go, then maybe that isn't the right course of action either. So they have that delicate balance to strike, but they aren't being pushed around in the sense that it's not seen as that if Dan Ashworth goes, suddenly the walls crumble around Newcastle. That's very much not the case. Yes, he's a very important member of staff. They headhunted him, but it's not that they don't think they can move forward without him.
There probably is an element, though, of kind of the inherent state of Newcastle behind this in terms of Newcastle's PSR situation is well known about, how they're up against the limit. And It's obviously there's a big debate over whether PSR FFP rules do unfairly inhibit smaller clubs from rising up. And it's left Newcastle in a position where this summer you could argue that Ashworth's main job is to sell
to
a player,
on,
arguably to free up Manchester United. Despite what Eric Ten Hag said, have a lot more spending money to play with. And actually, it means there's a lot more which could potentially come into or under Ashworth's remit in terms of freedom to actually kind of achieve an element of that revolution. And so it's not so much pushed around in the sense of Manchester United will come and take whatever Newcastle want. It's just because of the current sizes of the club at the moment, to do with income, revenue, spending power, market power, means that these sorts of things do happen. It's one of the first things. It's not a player you've lost first. It's potentially the sporting director because of these FFP restrictions.
Right, then let's move on from Ashworth before we take a little bit of a break. There has been one bit of business confirmed this week, Chris. Emil Kraft has signed his contract extension.
Yeah, I mean, I saw quite a few people's reaction to this on social media, as in this is typical Newcastle when it seems the world is burning around and then they announce what seems to be a minor positive. Yeah. I think the timing was coincidental, to be fair, on the club on that front, but there was obviously Lewis Miley signed his contract extension at the start of the week of transfer deadline day in January when it became clear they weren't going to do anything, but Emil Kraft has signed this contract extension. It had been trailed last week. I think it was somewhere in Sweden itself where it had been reported, and then it was confirmed by Eddie Howe at his press conference last Friday that it was likely to come, and this is an option which has been basically exercised within his contract. So this is a year's extension. I'm not sure whether it required both sides or whether it was Newcastle or Kraft or what it was, a mutual sort of agreement, but Newcastle are very happy with that. A, it protects value if they do decide to move him on this summer, but B, he has shown that although he's only made 9 appearances this season, the majority of them being as a substitute since he's come back from his ACL injury, he is a reliable, dependable defender who can play both as fullback and as a centre-back, and he's very, very positively seen behind the scenes at Newcastle. They really do value him very highly. So yes, that's the logic behind that.
I've seen him described by a few people on social media as deadwood, and I didn't particularly like that term when referring to Emil Kraft. I mean, we have to remember he came back from a pretty horrific injury last year. He's proven himself to be Johnny on the spot when Eddie Howe needs him. He's done what is required. He's an able deputy. He won't whinge. He won't kick up a fuss. And he's probably going to be fairly happy just to sit and make up the numbers on the bench. And you need a squad, Jacob, don't you? You need a squad of players. You can't always have superstars. You can't always sign top talent. You have to have those players who are prepared to sit and wait for a chance.
What kind of wood is he?
Very much a live wood.
I mean, we're talking very something. Talking something quite versatile, relatively stylish, strong.
Is Emil Kraft stylish?
I think for a defender, he's relatively so. Especially if he's playing centre-back.
He looks quite a lot like that horrific statue they made of Cristiano Ronaldo, which is in Madeira. He looks quite a lot like that statue. So they've got, if you go to Madeira, it looks like they've got a statue of Emil Kraft in the town square.
That rudeness was completely uncalled for, and I'm sure that Emil Kraft's lawyers will be in contact soon. So thank you very much, Taylor.
Absolutely.
I'd give him a nice compliment about being like Teak, and you have to go and compare him to other famously horrific statue. It's like saying no one wants to be told like they look like Edvard Munch's The Scream, do they? Like,
definitely not. Right, chaps, should we have a little break and we'll be back in a moment?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Come on, you Maggies.
Right then, boys. Saturday, 3 p.m. St. James's Park, Newcastle against Bournemouth. Should be no problem, Chris, right?
Well, hopefully. But this is... You've come to me wanting positivity.
Come on, Chris. Yeah, positivity. So. Come on.
Well, Newcastle United won their last match in the Premier League. So, therefore, they are in form. Are they in form? Can that be said to be in form? Their St. James's Park recent record has not been great, though. They obviously have lost their last three on Tyneside, which is the complete reverse of the first half of the season, and yet their away form has picked up and they've won four in a row in all competitions on the road. I do think that given Bournemouth's struggling form, and given that I think that Newcastle's coaching staff feel that they are getting closer to a formula which is going to serve them well going forward. Defensively, obviously, they've had significant issues recently. They're conceding far too many goals.
Yeah.
But they are scoring goals. They're particularly potent from set pieces. And I think there's a determination to get back to winning ways at St. James's Park this weekend. And I do think they've got a very, very good opportunity to do so. It may be a bit nervy early on until Newcastle maybe... Well, I mean, they've taken the lead in the last couple of two of the last three home games and haven't gone on to win them either. But, no, actually, the last three, I think they have. But anyway, I do think this is a very good opportunity against a side who had hit some very, very good form, but the last couple of weeks have struggled a little bit more. And Newcastle hopefully will have a couple of players, if not back, they're nearly back and pushing to be in around that first team squad who they've sorely missed. And yes, that's a roundabout way of me saying, yes, I think Newcastle are going to win. But then I also say that with slight trepidation because my predictions are usually terrible. So people are probably telling me not to make a prediction.
I haven't won a ballot for those last three home games that we've lost. And then I've managed to win the ballot for Bournemouth, so I've got a ticket. I'm not saying the two things are definitely linked, but I think it's pretty nailed on that we're going to win this.
Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, hopefully. We don't have a particularly brilliant record in the Eddie Howe derby, Jacob, do we? Maybe a bit of PTSD from our trip down there.
Yeah, it was really kind of in the dark days, not just of winter, but also of Newcastle's injury crisis. And Bournemouth really just outworked Newcastle in every single department, it felt like. And is when Andoni Iraola's sort of messages were just sort of starting to resonate with Bournemouth's players. So you went into them at a bad time. I think it is quite interesting as well. I've enjoyed watching Newcastle Twitter this week both be slightly wary about the prospect of Bournemouth given the reverse fixture and kind of a bit pessimistic about Newcastle's chance of winning, while also insisting that two of Bournemouth's best players in Philip Billing and Lloyd Kelly are both utter dog shit and you don't want them anywhere.
That's it, yeah. There's been a lot of that, hasn't there? Kieran Trippier had a fun night the last time, didn't he, Chris? He's getting back to his best, though, now, isn't he?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is after that Bournemouth game, which was the 2-0 defeat in November, and it did feel like, I think someone inside the club described it as that felt like the night that they fell off a cliff as a squad, given the injury situation.
Yeah.
That Kieran Trippier did have an exchange with a fan afterwards and was basically trying to defend the players in the group for what admittedly had been a terrible performance, but really it was the culmination of so many factors that had led to that. But Trippier then had a very difficult winter, as we all know, the mistakes at Everton, mistakes at Spurs, mistakes at Chelsea in the Cup, and he is starting to really rediscover that top form. He's now joint top assist maker in the Premier League this season with 10, as we talked about on Monday's show. The first player, Newcastle player, to reach double figures in assists since Laurent Robert 20 years ago. And he is just fundamental to what they do. His set pieces have been brilliant. His defending has improved again, albeit in a team which is struggling to sort of keep the ball out of its own net at the moment. He is looking much improved there. And he also played that sort of inverted fullback role last weekend, which apparently he's been doing all season, yeah. Eddie Howe told me. But yes, this is
shame on you for not picking that up, Chris. Shame
on
you.
But terrible. Yes, he remains fundamental to what Newcastle United do. They are just a few of the reasons why the ownership in January made sure that when Bayern Munich came for Kieran Trippier, that Newcastle United were going to keep hold of him, because he is still fundamental to what they want to achieve on and off the field.
Do you think we could see him play that inverted role again this weekend, Chris? Do you think it could be a similar formation to Forrest, or do you think it needs to be tweaked a little bit?
I think it will be tweaked. I think that there's going to be occasions when that will be more relevant than others. I think at home, maybe less need for him to be the inverted sort of fullback, because I think that Newcastle want him going down the wing as often as possible and getting forward. You probably will see him on occasion doing it, but whether Bruno Guimaraes plays as the number 8 again, I'm unsure whether that will be the case. At home, again, playing him as the number 6 probably makes slightly more sense, because you'd expect Newcastle to have more of the ball, and therefore you'd want him to be on it a little bit more rather than capitalising it on maybe a few occasions you get it away from home. So I think that we'll see a slight tweak again. I don't know exactly what that will be, but I do think that you will see a tweak again in that system.
Just to echo what Chris said there about where Bruno Guimaraes plays, Bournemouth's big thing is the kind of complexity of their pressing systems or intensity. And that, I think, means for the base of midfield, you want to have your technically best player in terms of receiving and distributing. Last season, Bruno, I think, had the second highest pass completion rate while under pressure in the entire league. And so I suppose, obviously, Newcastle want to play their own game, but you also do, to an extent, want to try and nullify the opponent's biggest strength. And putting Bruno there really does, I think, deal with some of those issues.
There was another listener, Brendan O'Kane, tweeted this in as well about Bruno and whether he should be an 8 or a 6. We should play him as an 8 when trying to avoid a booking, Chris. That's a pretty good point, isn't it? He didn't get booked against Forest.
He didn't, although he has gone a few games now without a booking. I'm not exactly sure how many it is, I'd have to check, but he has managed to avoid having basically picked one up every week for the course, or every match for in a short space of time. He has gone a few weeks now.
Is it another 10 he has to get through, Chris? 10?
I think it's,
or 9?
It's to, I think it's another 8. He's got to get to, I think it's week,
oh, 8.
Yeah, I think,
right.
It's another 8, so I think he's not too far away now.
Gillinton did manage to lead the league in yellow cards from number 8 though last season. To be fair to him, it's not a sort of bubble of a position, is it? Although maybe that says more about Gillinton.
Don't they give him like a 4 yellow card head start though at the start of the year, like a handicap? I'm sure he just has that anyway. There is still a big Joe Linton shaped hole in that midfield though, isn't there, Chris? We do miss him.
Without doubt. I mean, just what he brings in terms of physical presence, ability to cover ground, win those duels, the physicality in midfield. Newcastle just don't have anyone similar to that, and part of the way of trying to combat that last week was to have Trippier there as an extra body in midfield and also to move things around a little bit, and it worked to a certain degree. But then you still saw that the way that Forrest equalised the first equaliser, there's just still massive gaps in the middle of the pitch. And don't get me wrong, it wasn't working ideally when Joe Linton was fit. It's not as if Newcastle were winning every single match even when Joe Linton was fit throughout December, but he does bring something unique to that midfield. I'd say he's almost unique as a player relative to anyone else just about in the Premier League. There are certain similar characteristics that players have, but not in exactly the same way as Joe Linton has them. Now, if Joe Willock was fit, it wouldn't remedy all of those issues, but at least you would have a runner. He'd have greater legs in midfield. They don't have that right now in Newcastle United, and definitely Joe Linton's presence has been sorely missed by so many, including, I think, Bruno Guimaraes as well, as he played last weekend.
Yeah.
For the most part, over the course of the last few weeks, I think you can see that he is missing someone alongside him who can win those duels for him.
just to bring together, I suppose, a few of the disparate strands of this podcast, Dan Ashworth's kind of pressing concern at the moment is, can he get Gillinton to sign a new contract? And I think it's a really interesting discussion because we know how reliant he is on this physical play style. He is getting older, into his late 20s. And so you start to have these really interesting questions of just quite how high should Newcastle go? The Premier League, for a bit of background here, are planning to sort of reform the PSR laws into a form of FFP, which will include a wage cap cost, which eventually will be wages have to be around 85% of annual revenue. That'll go down to 70% if you're in UEFA competition. And the club will start to have to be pretty hot on wages. So I think it is an interesting topic to have. When Newcastle are trying to sign more and more players, to what extent, Gillinton is obviously a brilliant player, especially over the last couple of years, I'm not disputing that, but is that really where the money should be invested, into a midfielder who plays a highly intense style who's about to head into his 30s?
So, Chris, we've had a bit of a bombshell on Callum Wilson today, haven't we? Do you think there's a chance we could see Anthony Gordon through the middle?
Well, that's looking increasingly likely because Callum Wilson's injury, muscular injury that she suffered last weekend, initially Newcastle sort of as a positive because it didn't seem to be a shoulder injury, and Newcastle have obviously had a lot of those this season. Then they thought it was an arm muscle injury. It's actually a pectoral injury, which is going to require surgery.
Yeah.
And so Callum Wilson looks set for another extended spell on the sidelines. It looks like he's going to be out for up to 12 weeks. Might not be quite as long as that, but you're looking 2 to 3 months potentially. Mm. So you're not going to see him until probably the end of April, maybe the start of May. And that is a huge blow for Newcastle United.
So we can add broken tit to the long list of ridiculous injuries that we've picked up this season.
Newcastle are just going for every single weird and wonderful injury that you'd never heard of before. Yeah, they're just bringing them in and just trying. Now that they've had so many, they've just got to bring in different and interesting ones. And Newcastle can't catch a break. It literally is one step forward, one hop back at the moment. And that sounds like I'm making light of it, but it really is frustrating for Eddie Howe and everyone at the club, because they, no matter when it seems that injuries are ceasing, obviously Harvey Barnes being back the last couple of weeks, hopefully Joe Willock back soon, another one just crops up. And that means that it increases the likelihood of Newcastle suffering another injury in attack, and that it's just like self-perpetuating, and that's the real frustration.
Just waiting for Sean Longstaff to be ruled out for 3 months with a dislocated perineum. You know, this is the sort of ridiculous levels we're getting at now, isn't it? And one person we don't want to see re-injured as well is Harvey Barnes, Chris, just making his comeback now. We don't want to lose him again, do we?
Howe didn't want to risk him last weekend, partly because he ended up having Gordon fit and available, but Barnes, they've been very careful with, but if they can get him into the starting lineup, I think that Newcastle, it would be an interesting and fluid front three. It wouldn't be ideal because they did lack a focal point, I thought, at times against Luton when they didn't have a central striker on the pitch. But you also saw when Gordon manages to get out wide, when Newcastle catch someone on the break, they can be dangerous as well. So Joe Willock is getting closer, but I still think this weekend, certainly to start, he may be in and around the squad, but might be just a little bit too soon. Hopefully, by the end of February, Newcastle will be in a stronger position injuries-wise, but every single week, someone still seems to go down. So I do say that very yeah, much, fingers crossed.
Yes, fingers crossed, absolutely. Right then, lastly, good luck to the lasses. They host Derby County at Kingston Park on Sunday, and we should be getting some of George's behind-the-scenes coverage of their progress on Monday. Any more for any more, chaps? Anything else to discuss before we finish? No? Good. All right, that's that.
I did enjoy, I don't know if any of you saw, the fella who was talking on Twitter about being at parents' evening with Gillinton.
Good Lord.
And the idea of just having him sat down next to you discussing kind of geography.
As a teacher, if Joe Linton sat down in front of me, I'd be like, yeah, he's fine, mate. Nothing to worry about. No problems at all. Just carry on the way you are.
Best pupil I've ever had.
Yeah. Even if the kid was a little shit, you'd still say, no, he's fine, mate. No, I don't want to piss Joe Linton off. That's how it works.
Well, I know you could go the other way and go sort of like Dead Poets Society on it and try and really build a bond, and it's your way into Gillinton's heart.
And me and Gillinton would be best mates. Yeah, I can't see it working.
The way to convince him to sign a contract, tough love, are you saying, Jacob?
Potentially. I suppose there's a few Newcastle kids who are the same age as your one, Chris. You could find yourself at parents' evening in the next few years.
We can only try. Yeah, I imagine I get shunned by all of those. But if I ask any questions, I'm sure Eddie Howe would make sure on the basis of how press conferences go that, yeah, they'd make sure to shun me.
Lewis Miley's mum and dad still have to go to parents' evening, don't they? Bless them.
They literally did until about 18 months ago, so yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Right then, lads, that's it, lads. Let's finish off. Thank you very much for listening. Get in touch at Pod on the Tyne on Twitter or X. Email us at podonthetyne@theathletic.com. Jacob Whitehead, lovely to see you, dear boy, as always.
Ta-ra. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. And thank you to you, Christopher Woff.
You're very welcome. How do we think that George will be finding his sort of him being benched for this week, for this match? I think it was essential, but how do you think he'd have taken it?
I think he's quite happy, to be honest. I think he's needed a lie down in a dark room with a flannel over his eyes for a while, hasn't he? So hopefully that's what he's doing today. Yeah, bless you, George. Wishing you all the best, mate. Hope you're well. Right, that's it. Thanks very much for listening. This has been Pod on the Tyne. Have a good weekend. Take care of yourselves, and we shall speak to you on Monday. Ta-ta.
The Athletic.